Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we distill complex info into, well, surprising facts and key insights just for you. Today, we're really jumping into the very building blocks of life itself.
Yeah, we're using two fantastic lectures by Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman as our guide. He just peels back the layers on these core molecules that make life work.
Exactly. Our mission is to really get a handle on these fundamental biological macromolecules. What are they? How do they work?
And, you know, understanding them is so foundational. If you grasp the structure and function here, it unlocks insight into pretty much every biological process.
Dr. Hoffman really does make it clear, doesn't he? Even the dense stuff.
He does. He shows how life operates at its most basic molecular level. It's fascinating.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Dr. Hoffman kicks off by surveying the four essential biological macromolecules. Can you remind us?
Sure. Proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, and polysaccharides. Those are the big four.
Right. And he makes a key distinction straight away. Three are polymers.
Exactly. Polysaccharides, polynucleotides, which you probably know as nucleic acids like DNA and RNA and proteins, or polypeptides, they're all built by stringing together smaller repeating units, monomers.
But lipids are the odd ones out.
Yeah, they're large molecules, definitely macromolecules, but they aren't polymers in that same repeating unit sense. It's an important difference in structure.
Okay. And for all of these, Dr. Hoffman talks about two fundamental chemical reactions, like the yin and yang of biochemistry.
Huh, yeah, kind of. The first is the dehydration reaction. This is about anabolism, the building side of metabolism, putting things together.
Dehydration. So taking water out.
Precisely. As smaller pieces, monomers, link up and O and an H are removed from them, which combine to form a water molecule H2O. That water leaves and boom, the pieces form a strong covalent bond.
So you literally dehydrate the situation to build something bigger. Okay, that makes sense. What about breaking them down?
That's the reverse. Hydrolysis. This is the breaking downside, catabolism.
Hydrolysis.
Water splitting. Exactly. Water is actually an input here. It gets split and its components, an H and an OH, are added back to the larger molecule, breaking that covalent bond. So you get smaller chunks again.
So build up by removing water, break down by adding water. That's the core dance.
That's the core chemical dance of all metabolism, yeah. Dr. Hoffman emphasizes these two constantly.
And he has that neat linguistic trick too, right?
Yeah.
Anabolism, catabolism,
right.
Like anode, cathode.
Exactly, or those fish anadromous swimming upriver, catadromous going down. Helps remember their opposites. And metabolism, well, that's just the sum total of all these building and breaking reactions. It's life itself, really.
Okay, fundamental stuff. So let's move to the first specific group, carbohydrates.
Right, and Dr. Hoffman clarifies that carbohydrates is kind of a broad term. The macromolecule we're really focused on is polysaccharides.
Which are built from?
Monosaccharides.
Yeah.
Simple sugars. Think glucose.
And the name carbohydrate, he explains that, comes from the general formula, right? CnH2 and on.
Yep. Basically, carbon plus water in that fixed ratio, hence carbohydrate.
And how does he classify these simple sugars, these monosaccharides?
Well, a couple of ways. First, by the number of carbons. You've got trioses, 3 carbons, pentoses, 5 carbons, like ribose and deoxyribose, which are crucial for RNA and DNA.
Ah, right.
And hexoses, 6 carbons. Glucose is the famous one there.
And he mentioned isomers, too. Same formula, different structure.
Yes. Like glucose and galactose, same atoms, C6H12O6, but arranged just slightly differently, which gives them the different properties. It's amazing how small changes matter.
What other ways does he categorize them beyond just the carbon count?
He also looks at the location of a key chemical group, the carbonyl group. Is it at the end making it an aldose or in the middle making it a ketose? He has a little trick, aldehydealdose starts with A near the tip or end of the alphabet, so the groups at the tip or end of the molecule.
Clever. So how do these monosaccharides link up to form the big polysaccharides?
Well, first, Dr. Hoffman notes they generally have to be in their ringed form, not their straight chain form. Then it's that dehydration reaction again.
Taking out water.
Exactly. Taking out water to form a specific covalent bond he calls a glycosidic linkage. That connects 2 sugar rings.
And you can link lots of them. Disaccharides, oligosaccharides.
And eventually huge polysaccharides. Starch, cellulose, glycogen, they're all polysaccharides.
Now here's something Dr. Hoffman highlighted that I found really cool. Branching.
Yes. Unlike some other polymers we'll talk about, polysaccharides can branch. Because those sugar rings have multiple spots where another glycosidic linkage can form. So you don't just get straight chains.
They can look more like trees.
Kind of, yeah. And that structure relates directly to function. Dr. Hoffman gives 2 main functional categories. First, Storage polysaccharides.
Like starch in potatoes.
Exactly. Starch in plants. And glycogen in animals, mostly in our liver and muscles. Both are just chains of glucose.
And the liver uses those reactions we talked about, dehydration and hydrolysis.
Constantly. When your blood glucose is high, say after a meal, your liver uses dehydration reactions to link glucose molecules together, building glycogen for storage. It packs it away.
And when blood sugar drops,
hydrolysis kicks in. The liver breaks down that stored glycogen, releasing glucose back into the blood to keep your levels stable, especially for your brain, which needs a lot of it. It's a vital buffer system.
Okay, so storage is one function. What's the other?
Structural polysaccharides. Think cellulose. It forms the tough cell walls of plants. It's what makes vegetables crisp.
And chitin?
Yep, chitin. Found in insect exoskeletons, fungi cell walls. Dr. Hoffman mentions it's even used sometimes for surgical thread because it's strong and dissolves over time.
Now, Dr. Hoffman points out something crucial about starch and cellulose. They're both made of glucose, right?
Entirely glucose monomers.
Yeah.
But they are incredibly different in their properties. Starch is digestible energy storage. Cellulose is tough structure.
How can that be if they're made of the same thing?
It comes down to a tiny difference in the glucose itself. Starch uses alpha glucose. The way these link up makes the chain coil up, kind of helical, good for packing energy densely. Cellulose, on the other hand, uses beta glucose. That slight difference in linkage makes the chain stay straight and linear. And these straight chains can line up parallel to each other and form hydrogen bonds between them.
Ah, creating strong fibers.
Exactly. Incredibly strong microfibrils. Perfect for building walls.
And this leads to what Dr. Hoffman calls the refuge problem for us, right?
Right. Cellulose is packed with glucose, tons of energy locked away. But humans can't digest it. We lack the enzyme needed to break those specific beta-glycosidic linkages in cellulose.
So it just passes through.
Pretty much. Fiber. It's like, as Dr. Hoffman might put it, having a locked treasure chest full of energy but no key.
But cows can eat grass all day.
Right. Ruminants like cows, sheep, goats, they don't have the enzyme either, but they have a secret weapon. They house symbiotic microorganisms, bacteria, protists in their digestive systems.
And those microbes make the enzyme.
Those microbes make the enzyme, cellulase, that breaks down cellulose. The microbes get food and shelter. The cow gets the glucose unlocked from the cellulose. Dr. Hoffman calls it a beautiful example of mutualistic endosymbiosis. Both partners benefit immensely.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, let's shift gears to the next group. Lipids.
Lipids. Remember, Dr. Hoffman stresses these are large macromolecules, but not polymers in that same monomer chain sense.
And the most familiar type are fats, also called
triglycerides, or technically triacylglycerols. That's the main type of fat we eat and store.
So what's their structure like?
It's pretty neat. You have a backbone molecule called glycerol. It's a type of alcohol, specifically a triple alcohol. It has three hydroxyl groups.
Okay.
And attached to each of those hydroxyl groups via another dehydration reaction is a fatty acid.
So three fatty acids attached to one glycerol.
Triglyceride.
Exactly. And the bond formed is called an ester linkage.
And fatty acids. Those are the long chains. Long hydrocarbon chains. Mostly carbon and hydrogen atoms linked together. And because those CH bonds are nonpolar, fatty acids don't mix well with water. They're hydrophobic.
Like oil and water.
Precisely. And those long hydrocarbon chains are packed with energy. Think of gasoline. It's mostly hydrocarbons, too. Lots of energy stored in those bonds.
Which is why Dr. Hoffman points out fats are such efficient energy storage, right? More bang for your buck, gram for gram.
Way more. More than twice the energy per gram compared to carbohydrates or proteins. It makes evolutionary sense storing excess energy as fat is the most compact, lightweight way to do it. Great for survival when food isn't guaranteed.
He mentioned fatty acids can differ in a couple of ways.
Yeah, two main ways Dr. Hoffman highlights. First, the length of the hydrocarbon chain can vary. Second, and really importantly, is the degree of saturation.
Saturated versus unsaturated fat. We hear that a lot. What does it mean chemically?
Saturated means the carbon chain has only single bonds between the carbon atoms. It's saturated with as many hydrogen atoms as it can possibly hold. These chains tend to be straight.
Like butter. Solid at room temp.
Often, yeah. Animal fats are frequently high in saturated fatty acids. The straight chains can pack together tightly, making the fat solid.
And unsaturated.
Unsaturated fatty acids have one or more double bonds between carbons in the chain. This means fewer hydrogen atoms are attached. And crucially, each double bond creates a bend or kink in the chain.
Ah, so they can't pack as tightly.
Exactly. Those kinks keep the molecules further apart. So fats with lots of unsaturated fatty acids, like most plant oils or fish oils, tend to be liquid at room temperature.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, besides triglycerides, what's another super important lipid Dr. Hoffman discusses?
Phospholipids. He calls them monumentally important.
Why monumental?
Because life as we know it couldn't exist without cell membranes. And phospholipids are the primary building blocks of all cell membranes, the plasma membrane especially.
What makes them so special for membranes?
It's their amazing dual nature. Dr. Hoffman describes them as amphipathic.
Amphipathic, like amphibians living in water and land.
Sort of. It means dual feelings towards water. Each phospholipid has a part that loves water and a part that hates water.
How does that work?
Well, they have a head region containing a phosphate group, which is negatively charged and polar. This head is hydrophilic, water-loving. Then they have two fatty acid tails, which are long, nonpolar hydrocarbon chains. These tails are hydrophobic, water-fearing.
So one end likes water, the other end avoids it.
Exactly. And this property automatically makes them erase themselves in water. They form a bilayer 2 layers thick. The hydrophobic tails all point inwards, away from the water, facing each other. The hydrophilic heads point outwards, interacting with the watery environment inside and outside the cell.
Wow, so they self-assemble into the basic structure of a membrane just because of their chemistry?
Pretty much. It's a spontaneous arrangement driven by minimizing contact between the hydrophobic tails and water. Absolutely fundamental for creating compartments, which is what cells are.
Incredible. Did Dr. Hoffman mention any other lipids?
Briefly, yes. He touched on sterols, the most famous being cholesterol. You can recognize them by their characteristic structure. 4 fused carbon rings.
And cholesterol is important too, despite its bad rap sometimes.
Oh, definitely. It's a crucial component of animal cell membranes, helping maintain fluidity. And as Dr. Hoffman highlights, it's the precursor molecule from which all steroid hormones are made, like testosterone, estrogen, cortisol.
Wow. So from that same basic four-rim structure, you get hormones with wildly different functions.
Exactly. Minor tweaks to the rings and the groups attached to them lead to massive differences in biological activity. It's another example of structure determining function.
Okay. We've done carbs, lipids. What's next on Dr. Hoffman's list? The real workhorses.
Proteins, yes, the ultimate multitaskers. Dr. Hoffman says they do just about everything in biology.
And he makes a really crucial point here about DNA versus proteins, doesn't he?
He does. It's fundamental. DNA holds the instructions, the blueprint. But it's the proteins that are actually built from those instructions that carry out the functions and directly give an organism its traits.
Like eye color is determined by pigment proteins, muscle movement by contractile proteins.
Exactly. And one huge category he starts with is enzymes.
The catalysts.
Biological catalysts, yes. They speed up the thousands upon thousands of different chemical reactions that happen in your body. Metabolism, basically.
Yeah.
Without enzymes, those reactions would be far too slow to sustain life.
And they get reused, right? They don't get used up in the reaction.
Correct. They facilitate the reaction and then are ready for the next molecule. Highly efficient.
Now, Dr. Hoffman also clarified some terminology. Polypeptide versus protein.
Right. A polypeptide is technically a single unbranched chain of amino acids linked together. A protein can be just one functional polypeptide, or it can be what he calls a multiformer, made up of multiple polypeptide chains associated together.
Like hemoglobin having 4 chains.
Exactly. Hemoglobin is a multimeric protein.
So what are the building blocks, the monomers of polypeptides?
Amino acids. There are 20 common types used by essentially all life on Earth.
And they all have a similar basic structure.
Yes. A central carbon atom bonded to an amino group, NH2, a carboxyl group, DASH-UCOH, a hydrogen atom, and then the variable part, the R group, or side chain.
And that R group is what makes each amino acid different.
That's the key differentiator. The R group gives each amino acid its unique chemical properties. Dr. Hoffman groups them based on these properties.
Mm-hmm.
Some R groups are nonpolar, some are polar but uncharged, and some are fully charged, acidic or basic.
20 seems like not that many, considering the huge variety of proteins.
It doesn't seem like many, but the sequence you put them in is what matters. And it's actually compelling evidence for common ancestry, the fact that, you know, elephants, bacteria, oak trees, humans, we all use the same basic set of 20 amino acids to build our proteins.
How do these amino acids link together? Another dehydration reaction.
You got it. The carboxyl group of one amino acid reacts with the amino group of the next. Water is removed and a peptide bond is formed.
And Dr. Hoffman stressed something important about this linking process compared to polysaccharides.
Yes, a critical difference. Amino acids link up in only one specific way carboxyl to amino group. This means polypeptides cannot be branched. They are always linear chains.
So if they can't branch, what makes one polypeptide different from another?
Two things. Its length, the number of amino acids, and most importantly, the specific sequence of those amino acids.
The order matters.
The order is everything. Because those different R groups hanging off the polypeptide backbone interact with each other and with water in complex ways.
Mm-hmm.
These interactions cause the linear chain to fold up into a specific, intricate three-dimensional shape or conformation.
And that 3D shape is crucial for function.
Absolutely crucial. A protein's shape determines what it can bind to and how it works. The folding isn't random. It's dictated by the amino acid sequence.
What kinds of interactions hold the shape together?
Dr. Hoffman mentioned several. There can be strong covalent bonds called disulfide bridges between sulfur-containing R groups. Then there are weaker but numerous interactions. Hydrophobic interactions, nonpolar R groups clustering away from water, ionic bonds between oppositely charged R groups, and hydrogen bonds between polar R groups.
So the sequence dictates the shape. The shape dictates the function.
Precisely. He uses a great language analogy. You can have the same letters, amino acids, but rearranging them into different words, sequences, gives entirely different meanings, functions.
And this leads to his discussion of the four levels of protein structure.
Right. A way to describe the complexity of protein shape. Every protein has the first three levels, and multimeric proteins have the fourth as well.
Okay, what are they?
Primary structure is simply the linear sequence of amino acids, just the order, A, B, C, D.
Like beads on a string.
Exactly. Then secondary structure refers to localized, repeating folding patterns that form in certain segments of the polypeptide chain. The two main types Dr. Hoffman describes are the alpha helix, a corkscrew shape, and the beta pleated sheet, like a folded paper fan or accordion.
So local coils and folds within the chain.
Yes. Then tertiary structure is the overall complex three-dimensional shape of a single entire polypeptide chain. It's the result of all the interactions between the various R groups along that chain.
The final folded shape of one chain?
Right. And finally, quaternary structure. This only applies to proteins made of more than one polypeptide chain, multibillimers. It describes how those multiple chains fit together and arrange themselves to form the final functional protein complex, like how the four chains of hemoglobin assemble.
Got it. Primary sequence, local folds, overall chain shape, and how multiple chains fit together.
That's the hierarchy. He also briefly distinguishes between fibrous proteins, which are typically long, stringy, and structural, like collagen in your skin, and globular proteins, which are more compact, rounded, and often functional, like enzymes or hemoglobin.
And just how vital is that primary sequence? Does a small change really matter?
Hugely. Dr. Hoffman gives the classic, powerful example of sickle cell disease.
Ah, yes, you mentioned hemoglobin.
It's caused by a change in just one single amino acid out of the 146 in one of the hemoglobin chains. A glutamic acid, which is charged, gets replaced by a valine, which is nonpolar.
One tiny change?
One tiny change. But it alters the protein's tertiary structure, especially in low oxygen conditions. The mutant hemoglobin molecules tend to clump together, distorting the red blood cells into that characteristic sickle shape.
Which causes all the health problems associated with the disease.
Exactly. Blocked blood flow, pain, organ damage. It's a stark illustration of how absolutely critical the correct amino acid sequence is for protein structure and function.
What happens if a protein loses its shape? Can that happen?
Oh, yes. Dr. Hoffman talks about denaturation. This is when a protein loses its specific three-dimensional conformation and therefore its function, usually due to some drastic change in its environment.
Like what kind of change?
Things like extreme heat. Think cooking an egg white.
Mm-hmm.
The clear albumin protein denatures and turns white and solid. Or extreme changes in pH, like strong acids or bases. Or high salt concentrations, certain chemicals.
So you disrupt those weak interactions holding the shape together.
Exactly. The hydrogen bonds, ionic bonds, hydrophobic interactions get disrupted. And the protein unfolds, often irreversibly, like you can't uncook an egg.
But can it ever refold? He mentioned renaturation.
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah.
If the denaturing condition was mild and is removed, some proteins can spontaneously refold back into their correct functional shape. This is renaturation. But often, especially with heat, denaturation is permanent.
It's interesting. Is there anything that helps proteins fold correctly in the first place? It sounds complex.
There is. Dr. Hoffman mentions chaperone proteins, sometimes called chaperonins. These are other proteins whose job is to help newly made polypeptides fold into their correct shape.
Like a chaperone at a dance, keeping things proper.
Kind of. They provide a protected environment. shielding the folding polypeptide from other molecules in the crowded cell that might interfere or cause misfolding. They help ensure the protein achieves its proper functional conformation.
Okay, so proteins do the work. Built from amino acids, sequence is key. But what dictates the sequence? That brings us to the last group, right?
Exactly. That brings us full circle back to the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Nucleic acids. The link between DNA, RNA, and proteins is the core concept Dr. Hoffman calls gene expression.
Which he breaks down into two steps.
Two main steps. Transcription, making an RNA copy of a DNA gene, and translation, using that RNA message to build a protein.
So nucleic acids, DNA, and RNA are polymers too?
Yes, they are polynucleotides, and their monomers are called nucleotides.
Okay, what makes up a nucleotide? Dr. Hoffman detailed three parts.
Three parts. First, a 5-carbon sugar, a pentose. In RNA, ribonucleic acid, the sugar is ribose. In DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, it's deoxyribose.
Deoxy, meaning less oxygen.
Exactly. Deoxyribose has one less oxygen atom on one of its carbons compared to ribose. A tiny difference, but it affects the properties of DNA versus RNA.
Okay, so a pentose sugar. What else?
Second, a phosphate group. This part is the same in all nucleotides. It's negatively charged, which gives DNA and RNA their overall negative charge.
And the third part? The variable bit?
The nitrogenous base. This is what makes nucleotides different from each other. There are 5 main bases involved.
A, T, C, G, and U.
Right. In DNA, the bases are adenine A, guanine G, cytosine C, and thymine T. In RNA, thymine is replaced by uracil. So RNA has A, U, C, and G.
So a sugar, a phosphate, and a base make one nucleotide monomer, and they link up to form polynucleotides.
Correct. They link via dehydration reactions, again, forming a sugar-phosphate backbone.
And Dr. Hoffman describes DNA's famous structure.
The iconic double helix. Usually DNA exists as 2 polynucleotide strands wound around each other.
Yeah.
The sugar-phosphate backbones form the outside rails of the ladder.
And the bases form the rungs.
Exactly. The nitrogenous bases from opposite strands pair up in the middle, forming the rungs. Importantly, as Dr. Hoffman highlights, they're held together by hydrogen bonds.
Not strong covalent bonds.
No, weaker hydrogen bonds.
Yeah.
Which is crucial because the 2 strands need to be able to separate relatively easily for DNA's functions.
And the pairing is specific, right?
That's key. Absolutely fundamental. It's called complementarity. Adenine A always pairs with thymine, T, in DNA. Cytosine C always pairs with guanine. A with T, C with G. In RNA interactions, A pairs with U.
And this complementarity is the basis for, well, everything DNA does.
Pretty much. Dr. Hoffman emphasizes DNA's 2 major functions, both reliant on this complementarity. First is replication.
Making copies of itself.
Exactly. Before a cell divides, it needs to duplicate its DNA perfectly. The double helix unwinds, and each strand serves as a template. New nucleotides line up opposite their complements, A opposite T, C opposite G, on each template strand, and they get linked together, forming 2 identical DNA molecules.
Perfect copying, thanks to the pairing rules.
Yes. And the second major function is transcription.
Getting the instructions out to make proteins.
Right. In transcription, a specific segment of DNA, a gene, unwinds locally, and one strand serves as the template to build a complementary strand of messenger RNA, mRNA. Here, U pairs with A instead of T. This mRNA molecule then carries the genetic code out of the nucleus to the ribosomes, where it directs protein synthesis, translation.
So DNA stays safe like the master blueprint, and mRNA is the working copy.
That's a great analogy Dr. Hoffman uses. The DNA is the non-circulating reference manual in the library. The mRNA is the photocopy you take out to the workshop.
Wow. What an incredible journey through life's molecular toolkit. We've really unpacked the design and the vital roles of these 4 giants. Polysaccharides, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids.
It really is amazing how intricate yet elegant it all is. Dr. Hoffman's lectures truly shine a light on their complexity, but also their interconnectedness. They all work together.
Yeah, they're not just chemicals sitting there. As you said, they're the dynamic agents doing everything, powering cells, building structures, carrying information.
Defining our traits, enabling life to continue. It all comes down to these molecules and how they interact.
It really makes you think. If life depends so precisely on the structure and interactions of these molecules, what does the future hold? Especially as we get better and better at, you know, manipulating them with biotechnology, with genetic engineering.
That is the big question, isn't it? The possibilities and the responsibilities are immense.
Definitely something to keep exploring. We hope this deep dive has given you a solid foundation or perhaps a new appreciation for the incredible molecular machinery of life. Keep asking questions. Keep diving deeper.